Committee. We do have four issues before us today, and it'll be important to get the testimony and particular relative to the first House Joint Resolution, which we have before House Joint Resolution 35. And Wally Wisbrock is here today on behalf of the Treasurer's Office. Wally, would you like to come forward with the testimony, please, relative to House Joint Resolution 35?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Wally Wisbrock, Chief of Staff of the Oregon Treasury. With me is Cynthia Burns from the Attorney General's Office, who assisted us in our analysis of HGR 35. And let me just make some introductory comments, and then I'm available for any questions. I believe that Paul Warner handed out an analysis today to the committee that looks at the impact that HGR 35, if implemented in 1982, would have on state government today.
I don't think we have all the. I don't think we have that. All of us have the benefit of that handout at this particular point. He said that he had extra copies of it for the members of the committee, and I. There he is. There. He's got it in hand. We have a handout, Mr. Warner.
I guess since you don't have that in hand, I can make up anything that I...
I've got one in hand.
I stand corrected.
Okay, we have that now before.
And I'm sure Paul would be available for questions on it, and he's perhaps the best guy to answer any really complex or in-depth questions you may have about it. But basically, I can walk you through what the impact would be today. And this is, in part, relates to our concern, not just about the debt portion of it and the risk that we have to the general obligation debt of the state, but the overall impact that this is going to have on our bond rating. If you look at the chart and run over from 1999-2001, I'm looking at the 2054.1 number. That's $2,054,000,000. Had we started HJR 35 in 1982, just to give you a feel for what happens over a period of time with the cumulative impact of a bill like this, today we would be looking at a $2 billion shortfall over the budget that we have, the revenues that we have today. And the impact on education, the impact on health services is truly monumental. And that is the concern that the rating agencies have with this kind of resolution. It demeans and diminishes the quality of life in a state. It reduces the options for response under cataclysmic circumstances where you'd have to expand your revenues, and a $2 billion shortfall in today's dollars is catastrophic for the state. Specifically, our concerns related to the risk for general obligation bonds, and we addressed that in the last hearing. But I'm looking at language that reads, appropriations for such purposes in previous biennium should be no...
Where are you reading from?
Excuse me, I'm reading from the Android version of HJR 35.
Okay, lines
7 through about 7 and 8.
Okay, thank you.
The interpretation that we... A possible interpretation that can be given to that language that we've discussed with the Attorney General is that you have... that's really a line item restriction on expenditures. It could be the interpretation that's given to that language. And the concern is that by limiting, for example, the expenditures that you have that you can make for paying your general obligation debt to that kind of language, should your capacity drop, and we can see the kinds of reductions that we've had, if you look at Paul's, I'm going to compare a couple things, if you look at Paul's data, and you can see the kinds of reductions that we're talking about in government today. We would have a $2 billion shortfall, and by 2005 years, we would have just a $3.7 billion shortfall. That is going to constrain and shrink government. I mean, that's the intent of the bill. I'm not arguing that. The problem comes, you have line items. When we say, for such purposes, is very specific. You're going to spend money for a specific purpose. For such purposes, one of those purposes is the repayment of debt. And if you have the constitutional prohibition, it's not a money issue. If you have the constitutional prohibition, when you're reducing your revenues and you're reducing your expenditure capacity, if you have a constitutional prohibition from making up the difference in that drop, you violate the covenants of the bonds, you violate the contracts of the bonds, and basically you default on the bonds. That is catastrophic, and I don't use that term slightly. If the state of Oregon defaults on any debt, it's catastrophic for the state. It costs us, it's inconceivable that we could do that. It's inconceivable. You have a constitutional mandate. Part of the conflict that comes into it's a very poorly constructed bill. You have a constitutional mandate with general obligation debt that requires the state legislature, if it looks like there is a time of default, it requires the state legislature to levy a property tax to pay off the debt. You sign those covenants, it's law. This bill would be a direct conflict with the ability to do that. You have an expenditure appropriation that is reduced. You would not have the ability to levy that tax and extend that tax the way this bill was written. At least that's the interpretation. It's a possible interpretation that's given to us by the Attorney General. That's part of the risk that we have with the bill. And that's part of the concern that the bond rating agencies have with this bill. I've given this bill to the bond rating agencies and asked for their response. And I talked to the senior vice president with Moody's, and I said, this is the last version that we have. Do you still have the same concerns that I addressed with you 2 months ago? And they said, absolutely. Concerns are that you're reducing the general quality of life, a $2 billion reduction in today's capacity, for example, reducing the quality of life that you're going to have in the city, and there's also risk to debt. So there is a risk of future defaults on general obligation debt that is real. You're putting this into the Constitution of the state of Oregon. It's going to, the intent that you have, the intent that the drafters had when creating this bill is not important when we review the impact that this bill is going to have in the Constitution. It doesn't matter what your intent is. It matters what the language is. And you're going to have attorneys squabbling over that language. And you can't, it's not like a statute where you go back and you look at legislative intent. There is no legislative intent that is brought into the constitutional debate. You look at the language, and that's what people vote on. So what's going to be looked at is terms like, for such purposes, and I interpreted it, and this is why I asked the Attorney General to review, and I said, is my interpretation at all legitimate? My interpretation is that this is like a line item. We can't, for basic lines in the budget, we can't exceed it in future years. And that's the interpretation that is defensible. It is one of the interpretations that's defensible. If you put something like this in the Constitution, you live with it. And there is extraordinary risk to this state. The bill is poorly structured, and I think I addressed that once, but let me just be specific and give you two or three examples. The terms in this bill are really not defined. You have the term general fund. What is general fund? It's not defined. It's not defined at all. To get around the bill, or to make it more onerous, the legislature could interpret general fund any way you wanted to interpret general fund. Again, we're dealing with the Constitution of the state of Oregon here. We can't have changes to the Constitution that are that ambiguous. It leads to chaos, millions of dollars of court costs, and you know, it leaves the state hanging when we're trying to define these issues. The term appropriation isn't defined. Nor is, you know, another example, nor is the distribution process for excess revenues that are required in the bill to be sent back to the taxpayers. There's nothing clear about what the distribution process looks like. For example, if you had $10,000 excess, the way I read the bill, and I think the way the Attorney General understands the bill, that would have to be distributed to the taxpayers of the state of Oregon. $10,000. Well, how do you distribute $10,000 to the state of Oregon, to the taxpayers of Oregon? write a check for a half a penny? I don't know. That could be disputed. It will be in dispute. This language is ambiguous. It's a poorly constructed bill. It looks simple. A couple simple paragraphs. It is not simple. When you're changing the Constitution of the state of Oregon, you better know what you're doing, and this bill is ambiguous, I believe. The bill reduces, I think, in the future, and this is another concern of the rating agencies, reduces the flexibility of the future legislatures to address the needs of Oregonians. Should something happen that you can't anticipate, and I can't anticipate, something happen in 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 biennia, like the mandate from the voters of the state of Oregon to build more prisons, should that happen, you couldn't do it in the context of this bill. It would handcuff you. We could not do it. Future legislatures could not make that prudent judgment about how to respond to those explicit needs. There's a lottery conflict. The way we read the bill, should the lottery increase over the cap that is identified, the expenditure cap that is identified, those revenues over that cap would have to be distributed back to the voters of the state of Oregon. A year and a half ago, the voters approved including lottery expenditures for parks to support parks and natural resources. Voters have, and that was by, 68%? A huge turnout supporting that concept. And you're saying that you're going to take those monies that the voters of the state of Oregon understood that were going to go for parks and natural resources protection, and you're going to distribute them to taxpayers who didn't earn them. This is not a tax, but you would take that money and you would give it to taxpayers in spite of their direction that money would be spent for parks and recreation. They made the same vote to allow you to spend lottery dollars on education, and they made the same vote to allow lottery dollars to be spent on economic development. But instead, this bill would distribute those dollars, those excess dollars, back to taxpayers. And why the taxpayers when they never earned those dollars?
Your interpretation of, line 12 of the bill, general fund revenues would include lottery dollars.
Yep.
Is that right? Yes. Okay.
I think there's a case to be made on that. Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
The voters of the state have rejected the concept that's in H.R. 35, three times that I know of. The very similar bill to H.R. 35 was presented to the as an initiative and never got the signatures to get on the ballot. It was presented in 1990, 92, and 98. And I know there's a new measure that has already been filed with the Secretary of State's office to implement exactly the language of H.R. 35. I think Representative Harper did that about, 2 or 3 weeks ago. So we've had the opportunity for the voters to take a look at this in an initiative process, and it hasn't been embraced. So I don't think we're doing the will of the people here, the will of the voters. They've had the opportunity. They've rejected it soundly. It's never made it, as I understand, to the ballot. There's a couple other things that this bill would do, and it's because of the ambiguity. Because of the language I identified in general fund, ambiguity on general fund, what does it mean, and what will those lawsuits that we're going to have to defend before the Supreme Court of the state say about general fund? Where does the $2.4 billion that we're going to get in tobacco settlement money go? In general fund? Or can we play games with that and we put it in some other fund category? I mean, where does it go? How do we deal with the tobacco settlement money in relevant to this bill? Because we don't have the terms defined clearly, tightly, it can go about anywhere you want it to go. Let's put it another. I mean, and that seems to fly in the face of prudent judgment about how to manage money. Because of the lack of clarity on what those terms mean, it allows a legislature holds the size of a truck to drive through on issues like tobacco settlement money. And for $2.4 billion, you know that there's going to be games played with it. The voters of the state in the last general election also strongly endorsed, my gosh, I think it was about 70%, of the School Bond Guarantee Act. And it allows the state of Oregon to put an umbrella out with this bond rating and bring in school districts that want to issue debt under that bond rating. They can fall under that umbrella and they can issue debt using the state's credit rating, and it's saving tens of millions of dollars for local school districts. the threat that this bill has, and it's a real threat, because we've asked the rating agencies, the threat that this bill has to our bond rating is real enough to where those school districts would lose out if our bond rating drops. They would lose those tens of millions of dollars. You know, those are school dollars. It's not a lot of money. It's, you know, $60-80 million. But I think it's important. The voters have said we want the bond rating strong. We want the schools to be able to utilize that bond rating, fall under the bond rating. This weakens it. We haven't seen the amendments. I understand. I've been talked to with the amendments relate to. I don't think there's anything that changes what I've said here, you know, very briefly what I've said here, unless there's an amendment out there that really changes the total intent of the bill. And again, we haven't seen it. So I'm just addressing the bill as we've seen it. Let me just, you know, stop there and make myself available for questions and ask Cynthia if she had anything that I missed, which is probably a lot.
I think so.
Cynthia, I had a question about your letter to Marion Guest of June 8th. On the first page, this is relative to the impact of House Senate Resolution 35. And you've had some conversations with some other prior correspondents prior to that time, back as early as April, as close as I can tell here. In the very first paragraph on the first page, which is the first page, I guess, in the center of that, it talks about ad valorem taxes shall be levied annually upon a taxable property within the state of Oregon, insufficient amount to provide for the prompt payment of bonds issued pursuant to the to this article, referring back to Article 11G of the Oregon Constitution, and the interest thereon. Is it your opinion then, based upon your examination of House Senate Resolution 35, that would preclude us from being able to do that?
I think the way it should work mechanically is you have to juxtapose those constitutional provisions with another one in Article 9 that says no state monies can be spent except for with an appropriation. So if you read those two together, the logical conclusion then is that the state must levy this property tax and the legislature must make an appropriation sufficient then to pay the property tax monies that are generated to pay the debt service on the bond. So where you run into sort of a catch-22 situation here is that we have a limitation on that appropriation. So while we have a constitutional directive that says you must levy a property tax sufficient to pay the bond, and you need a corresponding then appropriation to pay those bonds, we've got a limitation on the appropriation that could be seen as a limit on the ability to then pay all those monies that are raised.
Okay, and then the next sentence is that this House Senate resolution may be read to limit this ability to levy the property tax and so conflict with the provisions of the Oregon Constitution authorizing the property tax levy to repay the state's general obligation bonds. Is it your opinion that in fact the general obligation bonds of the state of Oregon as they stand today are in any violation with the existing appropriations, which is statutory, appropriations language, which is statutory?
As long as the legislature continues to make the appropriations, there's no conflict. The Constitution will always, you know, sort of take precedence over the legislature. So I think the way the Constitution would be interpreted now is that the legislature has a constitutional obligation to appropriate sufficient amounts to pay those bonds.
The bonds themselves have the obligation and good faith of the real property behind them, do they not?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. So.
And really, appropriation is the mechanism through which the money that's levied gets paid out.
Okay.
Well, Chair, can I add that is a full faith and credit of the state that has been obligated.
Absolutely.
That has been clearly there's legal.
Absolutely. The full faith and credit, which includes the ability, and I wanted to make sure we understood that correctly, that the ad valorem taxes could be actually assessed against property in the state of Oregon to pay every one of those bonds off.
Correct.
Okay. All right. And the issue of general funds revenue never having been identified. I think the last sentence on the second page, currently income, I guess that's corporate and individual income tax, insurance, gifts, inheritance, cigarette, motor tobacco products, and other revenues received by the state are part of the general fund revenues. Thus, it would be consistent with the treatment of other tax revenues to construe such taxes as general fund revenues. Is there some serious definition issues then? I assume what you're raising here is the definitions issue of what could or could not be interpreted as general fund.
Right. The general fund is not a constitutional concept. If you try to find where the general fund, a definition of the general fund appears, there's nothing in the Constitution. And when you go to the statutes, you actually end up kind of backing into it, because what happens is you look at different sources of money
and anything else,
and they're directed to the general fund. But there isn't really any place that says there is hereby created the general fund and it shall consist of blah, 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 blah.
Well, it's everything that isn't specific fund.
Right, right? Basically. It's the catch-all part.
You know, that's the one thing I find interesting about the practice of law, and I'm not a lawyer. I've got a lot of lawyers in the family, so I've got to be careful on your lawyer, too. But it's interesting that you know, the general fund to me is a fairly easy thing, concept to sit here and try and define, because it really says it's everything that isn't specific fund, isn't it?
That's one way. That's a very logical interpretation that the court could put on it. It would say the general fund means all revenues that are not otherwise obligated to go somewhere else. The fact of the matter is, the way our statutes work, things get directed places, and they get either directed to the general fund into some account in the general fund, or they get specifically directed outside the general fund.
The reason I say that comment about the lawyers is generally, unless there's a definition of exactly what it is, then they say, well, then if it doesn't say you can, then obviously you can't. And so I guess that the catch-all phrase general fund revenues that has been used for all these many years comes under attack under this particular House Joint Resolution. When, yes, I understand that there are other sources of revenues that come in from time to time, whether they be lottery issues, and I think we act upon the lottery under separate documents, under separate budget instructions, and I recognize that there are certain provisions within the Constitution which says certain portions of the lottery will be directed in certain directions, and I suppose there's always going to be somebody that would like to challenge those various constitutional issues.
Actually, the one other place in the Constitution where the term the general fund appears is in the lottery statute, is in the lottery article.
Okay. How many times has it been challenged thus far?
I don't think anybody's ever addressed what the general fund is.
Okay. Well, but again, my comment is that really, if it's a special fund, it'll say special funds normally, whether it's a gas tax fund or whether it's other special funds for federal purposes, and then basically everything else pretty much flushes out.
Right. I think if something came in that didn't have a direction, the general fund is where it would end up.
Okay. I think relative to your letter to Marianne of June 8th, I think that your letter of April 13th to Marianne Guest of the Treasury's office, did it contemplate all of the A and gross provisions?
This memo addresses not the original version, but I think it addresses the A and gross version. There's only two versions of it, right? And so this was the A and gross version.
So April 13th, your letter of April 13th addresses the A and gross version?
Right.
The engross is
I had a proposed, I had a proposed amendment to House Joint Resolution. So I think that's what it must have been.
What I've done is I've broken your letter down into 13 salient paragraphs here of April 13th, and there appears that a large number of those issues are substantially resolved in the A and Gross, and that's why I asked about the A and Gross relative to your April 13 letter.
Yeah, I actually went through and marked on my thing what had been addressed and what hadn't, and a number of the issues I was looking at had been addressed.
Thank you. And let's see. Okay, and I understand that there may be some additional amendments here today as well. On page 4 of your April 13 letter, in the third paragraph down, the one that begins, in addition, there is no correlation between the sources of revenue and the entities to whom those revenues are repaid. You suggest in that paragraph that the definition of revenues be added to the bill that excludes funds that are already directed to specific purposes, funds that are donated to the state, federal funds or federal grants, contributions to local governments, employees' retirement funds, and other similar dedicated funds. Really, that was the intention in part of the constitutional amendment. That there was a general fund issue relative to the lottery amendment which was made previously, isn't that correct?
I'm sorry.
In other words, the general fund that's referred to presently in the Constitution, that's your understanding really of what is intended to mean the general fund, isn't it?
The revenues that I talk about in my letter as things that are dedicated to specific purposes, such as the retirement fund and things like that, I would say are not general fund revenues because they're specifically dedicated. But the problem is that there are things in the general fund they're put in the general fund pot, but they are dedicated to specific purposes. For instance, there are certain funds like the water, there's a water fund. That's an account in the general fund, and it has in it a whole pot of things that some of them are from federal sources that are dedicated to federal purposes. Some of it's bond money, some of it comes from different things.
But I guess what I'm saying is, again, these are items which are excluded from those specifically in order to come up with the balance left over to equal the general fund, in effect.
No, because federal grant money does go into the general fund.
There are federal grant monies that come in just as general fund items?
They come into an account that's established in the general fund. If you look at the one I'm thinking of is a water fund. And when you look at the statute that creates that fund, it says there is created in the general fund an account to be known as the water blah, blah, blah. And then it lists what sources of payment can go into that fund, and included in it are bond sale proceeds and federal monies that come from the feds for these water, sewer, water purposes or things like that. So it's kind of a whole hodgepodge.
Okay.
So there are federal monies that go into the general fund.
And those are, when we sit down and budget, we sit down with a budget before us and we identify sources of funds, and we have some limited funds, non-limited funds, general funds, other funds, and federal funds. Those would be broken out in the federal funds.
I don't know.
You probably ought to have, well, let's see, Senator Ferrioli is here specifically referring to a water fund. Any water funds that come from the federal government, I want to make sure that any funds that come in for the, and what program was it specifically?
It's like a water sewer program. I'm sorry, I don't know exactly. I just remember looking through the statutes, and it's it's
an economic development fund?
I think it may be, or a, no, it's a water resources fund.
Water resources fund.
Well, we just happen to have the expert on water resources fund, ranking on the committee right now, Senator Perioli. Senator Perioli, when you deal with multiple funds and ways and means, the resource itself, does it normally indicate general funds, federal funds, other funds, and limited funds? I'm going to ask Dallas this question too, on behalf of the Legislative Fiscal Office, don't we identify and break those down as they come in?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. When we do the spreadsheets, it's G and O. We have general funds and other funds, and then when we go into the budget details, the other funds are detailed specifically to sources, federal grants, cost share, whatever the source of the funds in the other funds.
Okay.
So we do know exactly where the dollars come in from and what we go after.
Okay. And Dallas, I need to check relative to the Legislative Fiscal Office. Are there federal grant funds that are expended for general fund purposes that we do not keep track of or that we do not actually budget as such, but we just request them through as general funds?
General funds are accounted for separately.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, all general funds are specifically identified.
Yeah, and federal funds are the same.
And the concern about that is that the major issue here is that there is no definition of general funds. And I'm saying that general funds is basically everything that isn't some special or specific fund that's kind of what's left over. And I just wanted to make sure that issue was at least discussed in some part here. And let me come back over to the next paragraph on your page 4, which is the last paragraph, and that's where you discuss perhaps the de minimis issue. House Resolution 35 requires that all excess revenues be distributed to certain taxpayers. There's no minimum amount that may not be distributed in terms of the total amount of the excess revenues or with respect to individual refund amounts. Now, assuming that we were very efficient and collected and dispersed down as Mr. Weisloff has indicated here today, to $10,000, that would be a de minimis amount. Can that be handled through the enabling legislation?
That's a matter for court interpretation, and I would say that if legislation were challenged that said a de minimis amount, whatever that's defined to be, doesn't have to be distributed back to the taxpayers. Our office would be the ones defending that, and we would certainly be making arguments to the court that was not the intent. It's an absurd result. The problem is that the Supreme Court has come out very recently, in fact, last week in a case, maybe 2 weeks ago, the Young v. State case with the overpayment and some more recent cases, where it is applied a template that it developed, a statutory construction, and it said that that's applicable to constitutional provisions at all. And the template basically is you look at the words of the statute, and you don't add what isn't there, and you don't subtract what's there, and even if you end up with an absurd result, we won't look beyond the words, and you're stuck with what's written there.
Mr. Chair.
So that's a little troubling.
Isn't that a great departure from where the Supreme Court has always historically looked at legislative intent comments such as what is being made today in terms of this hearing when they are deciding questions of this nature?
Yes. Mr. Chair,
it is
starting with the PDEV Volvi case in about 1993. That case came out, and they said this is the template we're going to follow, and we're going to look at the text and the context first, and the words that are there. And in reading the words, you can apply sort of rules of construction, which are don't add what isn't there, don't subtract what isn't there, and only if after you examine the text and the context, you find ambiguity, you can go to legislative history then. which is pretty easy. I mean, then what you do is end up that you're looking for ambiguity.
Well,
can go to the legislature.
According to Wally, this bill is full of ambiguity.
So, yeah, I'm not saying that they can't get there. The danger is that they have these recent cases, the Young versus State of Oregon, which is the overtime case where the legislature clearly intended to not exclude state managerial employees from the overtime provisions, but a lower court held that, going to legislative intent and things like that. The Supreme Court, or the Court of Appeals, just said, we're going to stick by PGE v. Boley, and even though it leads to an absurd result that we're sure the legislature didn't intend, that's not what the words say, and so you're stuck with it. And they used as the basis for that decision a recent Supreme Court case where they basically said, we're going to limit this absurd result doctrine. So how this got interpreted is sort of on dependent on how the Supreme Court's going to go with this template they've laid out. And there's some cases up there now that I think at least some people are trying to get them to back off on that analysis a little bit, but so far they haven't done it.
If the excess amount to be returned under this particular issue is calculated to be so small that it would be a marginal benefit as to a cost-benefit ratio, then that amount to be returned would probably be added to the ensuing year's cash carryover. Is basically your understanding, or would be my understanding of that particular point.
Mr. Chair, I think I can address the point of Representative Krupp also, that the problem is that we don't know. That's not what the bill says. It's statute. We're talking about a constitutional amendment. The ambiguity in the bill could lead us down a road that is not beneficial for the state of Oregon. That's our point. That if we're going to change the Constitution, if we're in fact going to do this, that it needs to be very clear. There needs to be time, a lot of hands, a lot of thought on it. And it's beyond us. And, you know, if you recall the testimony that I made the last time we were together, I suggested that, in fact, we couldn't solve the problems that are in this bill. They're flawed. It affects the Constitution of the state. That means the lives of a lot of people for a lot of years. And, in fact, if you're going to do that, then you need to get some people in here who understand bond law at the highest level, to understand constitutional law, and get your arms around it. This has a great risk to our very narrow niche, and that's the bond rating of the state of Oregon. And enough so that, you know, we're here for the second time at great risk, and, you know, we're certainly getting pummeled for it, but at great risk for being here. But it's my obligation to sit down here and tell you that the rating agencies that we have talked to, and I have talked to them after, you know, our last meeting, I took this document back and said, here's the discussion, you tell me if we still have risk, and they said, yes. And I'm not throwing that out lightly. It's a major concern to us. And because of the ambiguities in this bill, you know, we are really concerned and opposed. We can debate how these things could be interpreted. Unless they are crystal clear, and unless they're crystal clear to our Attorney General, I think we're going into this matter with great risk. And that's what we're trying to avoid. As your banker, we're trying to avoid that risk.
Okay.
If it could be misinterpreted, if it could be challenged in court, it will be. It's going to take us down a very ugly path, and there is risk in that path.
That's what my brother told me the other day, and he's a lawyer. He said that you start passing bad legislation over there, like gun control, that pretty soon people are going to start calling you bad names like defendant and former representative, things like that.
Defendant's one of the bars,
right? Defendant's very early.
The question was, is it a rateable risk that we're talking about? In other words, is the risk significant enough to be able to translate that into a lower rating for the bond offering?
Mr. Chair? If it was de minimis, I think we would not be making the case that we are now. I think the first thing that's going to happen with this, it'll be put on watch, and then the bond rating agencies don't tell you, they don't raise the threat of if it passes, we're going to lower your rating. They tell you we're deeply concerned. That kind of language. We're deeply concerned. Like a attorney student. I'm sorry. We're deeply concerned. There's a chance of watch. And if you look at the two states that have this legislation on their books, there are two, and their ratings are far below this state, California and Hawaii. And Representative Butler and I, Chair Butler and I, have had a brief conversation, and I will have to admit that I can't stand that lower rating on this kind of bill. I can't do it. But it's there, and it is a fact to be considered. Again, what we're concerned with is what the rating agencies have told us specifically with this bill, as it sits before you, that they are very concerned. And I think that leads to, watch, and watch usually leads to a downgrade, or there's that possibility, in particular if we have any stumbles in our economy.
Can I ask a question in that regard? Recognizing that California and Hawaii do have constitutional limitations, or some type of limitation, are they constitutional? And that's the case?
I don't know.
I can answer for Hawaii. It's in the
constitution.
I don't know
about California. How do they continue to overspend in Hawaii?
Mr. Chairman, the legislature when passing appropriations bills have clauses, whenever it exceeds the constitutional spending limitation, says notwithstanding it needs health needs and welfare or something like that of the state, and this will cause, we pass this, and they don't put it in dollars, but it says it will cause the expenditure limitation to be exceeded by some percentage, so it's not dollarized in the bill, but the legislature itself has the it's in the constitution also that the legislature can
as opposed to exceeded.
To exceed, okay. Yes.
This doesn't have any exceeding language, does it? This right. House Joint Resolution 35.
But the amendment does, doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
The A ten.
Okay. I'll tell you how you get around it, and that's part of the concern that we have. The ambiguity of this is that the future legislature would say these items are not general fund items. Healthcare is not a general fund item. Tobacco settlement revenues are not general fund items. And if they statutory act, you move it since it's not defined within the bill. And that's part of the concern that we have. I'm not arguing, against limitations here. I may have my feelings about that, but that's not what I'm arguing. I'm saying that this bill creates a problem for us the way it's written. It is ambiguous, and it brings risk. General fund isn't defined. Appropriations aren't defined. There's 113 accounts out there that get continuing appropriations. I said, unless amendments change that, we're in this. But that's our concern. This is a constitutional amendment that we're going to live with for a long time, and it's sloppy.
That's an acceptable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, the point about debt service certainly concerns me. You and I have had conversations about this, about the case bond rating and so forth. If those were addressed in the legislation and these other issues that were more defined, would that remove the treasurer's objection to this bill?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a great question. And I'm not sure that we know how to get all the risk to the bonds, specifically the bonds, out of here, and I've attested to that when we address bond issues, we have not only the Attorney General's office sitting with us, and they're certifiably smart people, and give them all of that credit, particularly Cynthia, she's a bond expert.
Suck up now.
But we bring in bond experts from around the country, and we have them sit down, and they always find something that we didn't see. It's just that it's such a very complex area that in three paragraphs you're not going to address those needs. So my answer would be, we can't take them out. That what I suggested last time is that, and we suggest on your dime because they're very expensive people, that come in and take a look at the language and see if we have what the risk is, for the bonds. But beyond that, and this is why I had asked the question of Moody's specifically and a very senior person at Moody's, and asked for candor, is the response to this kind of expenditure, revenue cap and expenditure cap and dispersal back and refunds back to taxes, and they're feeling about that, and it is very negative. They're saying, and this is beyond purely the scope of our bond, they're saying that it diminishes our the quality of life, potentially will diminish the quality of life in the state of Oregon. And I'd like to look back at this is what the revenue officer had developed his question. And we looked over this analysis, and I can't see how I can defend that argument with the bond rating agencies when I look at what our expenditures would be today. And trust me, they're following the budget debate as close as any citizen in the state of Oregon. Every day, they're following the debate that takes place here and what kind of budget we're going to get out. Because they pay attention to that, and it's important to them in terms of how they rate us. And if they see a $2 billion reduction in our capacity today to address the needs of Oregonians today, when we're haggling over $200 million in education, they see a $2 billion shortfall. Next session is a $2.5 billion shortfall.
No, wait a minute, Roy. Let's be really honest about this. That's the cumulative amount over the past 12 years.
I don't believe so.
Look at the heading up at the top. That's the cumulative. Millions.
Mr. Chair, and Paul is here, but my understanding is that this is the cumulative impact. Let me explain how I understand this here, and I could be off base. But if you have a $100 budget, and each year you have a $100 pot that you're going to develop a budget from, and you have to, let's say for 2 years, you have to take 5% away from that, and then figure out what your budget is going to be, you are dealing with a smaller base. What this is saying is...
Well, start back up with
1988-89.
Yep, sir. And look what it says on the general funds above the limit, based upon this Austrian resolution. It's 287, and that's the first year that you've been in a positive... Prior to that, you were in a negative. There wouldn't have been any return.
Correct.
And so that's 287 is the cumulative amount. And the next year, the next biennium, you've got 302.
Yes, sir.
And the 302 plus the 287 is the 631 or 632 million. So that's the cumulative amount over the past six biennia, is what you're talking about, 2.54 million. Really, the amount that we're looking at is the general funds limitation in millions of dollars, and the highlighted portion that he's got there, and I've had met earlier with Mr. Warner when he delivered this to me, and I'm sorry, he had a 2 o'clock meeting that he had to leave for, but using the DAS projections, the general fund limitation, or general fund return above the limitation right now would be $267.4 million for this year. For this biennium.
Correct.
Okay.
But what he's also saying is the limit of the impact in cumulative millions is that the base budget that you'd be dealing with, which is just to the right of the 267.4, that you'd be dealing with 8994. That would be the base budget that you're dealing with. The limit of the impact in cumulative millions. This is the base. That's how I understand it. The base budget that you're going to be dealing with is $8,994,000,000.
That's exactly what it is. He highlighted for me the general fund above the limitation of $267.4 million. He said that would be the amount that would be the obligation to be, as my understanding, to be returned to the taxpayers under this Hausman resolution.
Yes, sir. And you're absolutely right. That's on a one-year basis. It's for this
biennium.
It would be I believe it's a year. But the 267. I'm buying the 267. But that other column is suggesting each year you're reducing the base. Each year that we do this, each year that we make a reduction, you're reducing the base. And as I understood what Paul was laying out here, and I understand this, the base is reduced by that 267, but the base stays at the lower level when you move into the succeeding biennium. So, this is the intent. There's nobody's playing games with it. Paul, I think, got it right on. The intent is to reduce it. The cumulative impact of the reduction, I'm saying have this that implemented 1982, the cumulative impact of the reduction would bring us to the level where the base budget that we'd be dealing with today would be $8,994,000,000. So today, in solving the problems of Oregon today, instead of dealing with the budget that is $10.5 billion, $11 billion, you'd be dealing with $2 billion less.
So you're anticipating that every year you would return the cumulative amount.
Yeah.
Every biennium, you return the cumulative amount.
You're starting with a capped amount. The idea of this is to cap, and you move that cap forward. And as I understand the legislation, and this clearly lays out that in fact you're going to get there. You are going to severely, and that's the intent. You're going to drastically reduce the size of government in the state of Oregon. Now, I'm saying that the way the rating, your question was, and Representative Krupp's question was, if we remove the specific bond language, would the Treasury opine? And the answer is no, because of this kind of impact. And this is what the rating agencies are looking at. How do you address the overall quality of life and standard of living in the state of Oregon? They will be deeply concerned that instead of for example, today, instead of a budget of $11 billion-ish, that we would have $8.9 billion. That's the impact that we're dealing with. A budget of
$10,181,000,000. Okay. We'll need to get Mr. Warner, obviously, down here to explain that to us so that we can make sure that we're coming from the same direction as what we're getting an understanding of. It will be important that we understand that.
And I really appreciate that. So I think that the $267 million is a substantial number since we're scrambling now to find a couple hundred million dollars to get out of here. But the $2 billion, this takes us to, that's a crisis. And it'll be responded that way by the rating agencies. When they look at this and they do this kind of math and understand that the impact is going to be dramatic on the state. When we close the doors with them and share the conversation, they said, you always have an opportunity. You have an option. There are consequences for all these reactions. You can do something like this, and so what? So the rating agencies drop us down to a BBB. We don't issue debt, and that may be where people want to go. And they said, that's your choice. It's not
what
a choice
for Hawaii right now.
BBB.
BBB.
Or A minus or BBB.
California also.
California's a little higher than that. I've got something. BBB is as low as you can get without.
I think the difficulty they've got is they've got this net spending cap that they can
Hawaii's in A1, and that's an A1, really low. And I was talking to Mr. Smith, who's our debt management advisor, and he thinks that they have been downgraded another time. And this is of the last quarter, so I think there has been there's a recent downgrading, which I think takes them down to BBB.
How long has Hawaii had this in their constitution?
Adopted in the 1978 Constitutional Convention. I think it became effective in 1980.
Very similar to the timing of our current rate of growth appropriations was instituted in the Oregon.
79
and voted on page 1980.
Mr. Chair?
What's
that property tax again? What would happen to the bond agency's perception of this entire issue if we were to amend this bill such that the amount that we would in fact be returning, the excess amount, in this case, starting at $267 million. What would happen if we amended this bill such that all of that money in succeeding bienniums went into a reserve fund for the state, a rainy day fund, up until a limit was reached of, say, 10%? As a guarantee that there's a pool of money there to repay the general obligation bonds, and then anything beyond, once that 10% limit was reached, then that money then would be refunded back to the taxpayers as the bill originally describes. Would that, you think, cure the issue of making them nervous about our ability to repay those loans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I don't think the issue is purely being able to repay the bond. I think, so I need to segregate that out of your question. Their concern, and perhaps I was not clear in how I responded to your question and to Representative Butler's question. One of their concerns is that bonds be repaid. A major concern that they have that even overshadows that in my answer to your question, a major concern is the quality of life that we're capable of offering for Oregonians.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Raleigh, not to argue with you, but quality of life is a very subjective concept.
Sure.
And it seems to me that, I mean, I could make the case that as a poor mint farmer, that my quality of life would be just fine under this type of a bill, but someone else from a bond rating agency who lives in another state is used to greater culture and greater government largesse, shall we say, could look at our frugalness and say, well, that diminishes the quality of life, when in fact it may or may not, depending on your point of view. So if they're going to penalize us or any other state with a bond rating downgrade because they think that it will diminish our quality of life, then they could use that argument at any time. But we're spending 15% more, is our proposal. The governor, I think, is around 19% more in his proposal over the biennium. They could say that 19% wasn't enough. And they could use that same argument then. It's very subjective, and I don't understand how people who deal in numbers and from a banker's point of view could use a subjective term like that to make a determination in regards to a bond rating that affects the use of or affects the taxpayer money and how far it'll go, essentially. I guess I don't understand that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I think it's an excellent question and very articulate. I think part of the answer is that the quality of life is not the perk that I might consider in my language as quality of life. It's not going out to dinner an extra time. It's not the quality of life that they're talking about, or being able to provide essential services for the state. They address education. They're deeply concerned with education and how it's funded. They could, I don't think, care less about the governor's budget or the House budget. We're not talking that. What they're saying, are you able to supply the essential services that address a quality of life in the state of Oregon? And I understand that it is objective. We've addressed that as we talk to them. We understand. They understand that it's objective. And they say, at a point, as that quality of life is diminished, it affects your bond rating. It's very clear. And I don't think that there is a magic number for where it is. And I think they understand the subjectivity of that. But it's not frill. It's, can you address and look at $2 billion, let's assume I'm correct here, you look at $2 billion short today and address to me what happens if you have $2 billion left to put into the education system. Does that affect the quality of life in the state of Oregon? I think that crosses the line. I don't know where the line is, but to me, personally, that would have crossed the line big time. If we don't have the money to prepay for essential services in the state, we have a problem. And I think that's what they're addressing. That's what I'm addressing in terms of quality of life. A suggestion might be it's an articulate question, and it truly deserves some debate. It's the Constitution of the State of Oregon that we're talking about changing, and deserves a great deal of that discussion and debate.
Yeah,
A forum for that would be a lot of discussion. This bill perhaps puts some of those issues on the table. I'm suggesting it's premature. The ambiguity in the language, the construction of the bill is weak. And it will be challenged. Not by me. That's not what we do. It's going to be, if the ambiguity is there, and if you're creating that opportunity to be attacked, you will be attacked. You will be attacked on this bill. I don't know who's going to do it because it is so ambiguous, it's so poorly constructed that it's going to, you know, paralyze the state, in fact, until these issues are resolved. And not just because, and I'm not just talking about the bond rating concerns, you know that you're going to be litigating this thing forever. If in fact this is where the state wants to go, certainly it's not where the voters have said they want to go, but if this is where the state wants to go and the legislature wants to take us, let's have that debate. But get the people in here who can answer the technical questions. I'm answering for the rating agency. When I've asked them the question, gee, how do you read this bill? And they say, we don't like it because, you know, and I've identified the issues. They should be at the table. We should have them at the table. We should have some of the bond council people here that allow us to engage in that level of debate before we expose the state and future legislatures to the constraints that's in this bill.
Thank you very much, Riley. I think one of the things that we've experienced as members of this committee all has been the concern of how do you buttress up a fund, a rainy day fund or a reserve of some kind. Certainly you don't do it during hard times. You need to do it during good times, and we've been enjoying as the 5-year moving average indicates, we've been enjoying some pretty good times, and we've been able to put aside exactly nothing. Thus far, we've been able to expend more than we've brought in, and that's why the issue of the bonds comes up. And I think that the issue of having something set aside, the issue of the layers of taxation or types of taxation, which Oregon presently experiences, whether you're talking about property taxation under Measures 5, 47, and 50, or the income taxation under Chapter 1 of the Code, at this particular point, we've got just a limited resource from which to draw. And the good faith and credit of the state of Oregon has to pay off eventually those general obligation bonds, and I want to make sure that we make absolutely certain on the record that we are not in any doubt that we have the ability to pay that bond debt off, and Ms. Burns' letter certainly brings it up in a number of different places, but her letter of April 13th may have been answered in part. The letter of April, or of June 8th, may now, with some amendments, be answered in part. But I need to know from the construction of the joint resolution and looking at it itself, is show me or tell me, read into the language if you could, that shows that this is some sort of a cumulative reduction in the appropriations each year, as opposed to it's the average annual percentage change in the state's private sector income for the 5 calendar years preceding the biennium. Now, how does it become a cumulative effect as to the amount which would be returned? I'm real curious how you get that kind of annual cumulative effect out of the language there.
Paul is perhaps better position to answer that question.
I'm a lawyer in front of me, too. I want her to tell me.
Let me jump in. And I think it's because of the 5-year rolling average that you're looking at. It locks you into, you know, it stops the massive corporations, and I think, you know, that's a good idea. But it also locks you in, a bit also. So, I mean,
okay, so the
good news and bad news. But I think Paul's
first column is years, second is the private income, which is federal definition, less all government wages and salaries, and the third is the annual percentage change, and the fourth is the 5-year rolling average, or moving average. All right. Ms. Burns, from that, where do I read that the cumulative amount from all of the prior biennia is going to be subtracted from every year or every biennium thereafter?
Let me just tell you the way I read it, and I don't know if it jives with this chart or not. But when I read things like this, I try to put down simple numbers to figure out how it works.
Okay.
And it says in each biennium, beginning with the 2001 biennium, so let's say that's year one, the appropriations for state government expenditures in each biennium shall be no greater than the appropriations for such purposes in the previous biennium, increased or decreased by this rolling average percentage. So let's say you have year one, you had $100 in appropriations, and the rolling average number resulted in a decrease of 2%. Then in year two, the way I read this, your appropriations in year two have to be reduced, have to be an amount that's the previous year's amount reduced by 2%. So you get down to 98. And then you take that number and for the next biennium, you take your current year number, which is 98, and you get your rolling average, which let's say is again a reduction of 2%. And you have to apply that 2% reduction to year two to get the number for year three, which I don't know what that is. I don't know what 2% of 98 is, but let's say it's 96 for simplicity's sake. What is it?
3.5%.
Okay. So.
I have a shoe on. I'm sorry. Cutting with your
so I think that's where the cumulative effect comes in. But then let's say in year four, that the rolling, something happened and the economy was really good, so our average is actually increased by 2%. Then I think your expenditures for year four, you could add back in your 2% and you'd be back up at 98. So you're sort of going back and forth based on what happened in the previous year adjusted by this figure. So if you have years where the average continually declines, I think your numbers are going to continually decline. And then if you have good years, they're going to start to go the other way.
Well, sure, you can see that in all figures. I think as he's taken it from year 75, these are real numbers through 99. It has continuously ratcheted to the cumulative reduction. Continuously ratchets down and down and down and down.
Mr. Chair,
they're not hypothetical. That answers Representative Kreft's concern about dealing with real numbers, and these are the real numbers. And let me, I didn't also address Representative Kreft's suggestion about the rainy day fund. I would do, you know, a lot to get a rainy day fund. I think it's one of the most important things to this state. But having a rainy day fund in this bill doesn't solve the problem that I've addressed. And as much as that hurts, I would just reach out and grabbing the hand and say, let's figure out some way, other way of doing it. It's very important that we get the rainy day fund done. Doing it in the context of this bill doesn't get us there.
Actually, I have a bit of a misnomer, too, I think. I just was looking at, if year three is 95.5, because that's 98% reduced by 2%, and then you get to increase by 2% for the next year, you actually don't get all the way back up to 98 because 2% of 95.5 won't get you all the way back up because the 3.5% is 2% of 98, not 95.5. So you would have to need 2 years of increase to make up, I think.
That's precisely how I understand it. And that's how I understand it. We get down to the $8.9 billion, you know, for the budget that we'd be confronting today. What he's given you on the actuals of millions is the actual million dollars that you have today. The figure that we would be at, theoretically, if this had been implemented in 1982, and this is where he began, you know, Paul began his calculation, would be under the limit impact cumulative millions. That's the budget where we'd, those are the revenues that we get today.
$8.99 billion.
As opposed to 11, okay. Whatever, for 2000.
My understanding, and that's why I thought you highlighted it, that $267.4 million would be the amount that would be subject to the refund.
Precisely right, and that would be the refund, but it would be based upon the smaller budget figure. So even with the smaller budget figure, you're going to continue to ratchet it down, and you'd be giving back to the $267 million.
Mr. Chair, I would like to see a budget scenario that would start with the 2001 biennium, because that's the reality of what this bill would do. And I would like to see that, I'd like to see a numerical run that, as I read it here, 2001 is about a $11.5 billion general fund, is what they're anticipating. And I would like to see that ran out under this scenario for about a 20-year time period. It would be interesting to see what the cumulative effects would be, starting from a place of an $11.5 billion budget. If there was a $267 million cap, that was money that was or put into a rainy day fund or whatever. Seems to me that we're predicting allowable growth of 10.7% here in 2001, 2003 biennium. So that means that the state's general fund budget is going to balloon to the next biennium with a 10.8 to $13 billion, from 11.5 to $13 billion. That's, in my book, that's a $1.5 billion increase, again, based on a 10% allowable growth under this bill, under this initiative, constitutional change.
10.8% is the allowable growth.
Yes.
Two times the annual growth rate. That's an excellent case, excellent point, Russell Krupp. What you have here is, and what Mr. Warner has done, is that he has given us a history back to 1975 to get 25, 30 years worth of history and projection in this process, so that we can see what it would have done in good years and bad during the 70s and 80s, what the growth limitation would be. And we're not going to be starting back then. And so that's why I say we need to be real honest and straight about this. We're starting now, today, and if this was in fact law today, and assuming that it was read that the general fund is basically what we have been defining general fund for these many years, it does show up in the Constitution even without a definition. It's my understanding that at 2001, we would be returning $267.4 million, and one way or another, I think we're probably giving back $267.4 million in one form or another in tax credits or rebates or refunds or something of that nature. And whether or not those would qualify is a different story, but I think really we need to start with figures today, as opposed to saying that in today's market, because government has grown, and recognize that there's hundreds of millions of dollars that have accumulated in this past number of biennia that are just in a brand new state organ medical fund, the OMAP. So there's hundreds of millions of dollars there, and they're saying, well, gee, we just couldn't get along without that. Well, so many things that we couldn't get along without, we've become used to. And so this basically defines a new point in time, and that new point in time is projected under the gas projections at 10.7 through 2001 at $11.5 billion. At which point, $267 million would be returned, is my understanding, based upon that first round of refunds.
Sure, I appreciate the difference in our understanding of what this means. If sometime in the future, before we move forward on it, if you could ask Paul to explain it.
Yeah, he'll be back shortly, so we'll...
The historical perspective on this, I think, is really critical, because I'm not sure how we do a what-if going forward. I don't know when the economy is going to hit skids. We all know we're businessmen and women, and we know that nothing lasts forever. There are down times, there's good times, and I think the benefit of having this go back to 1975 is that you've got a good 25 years of review of what can happen in the state. It reflects, you know, probably pretty accurately of what the next 25 years looks like. We're going to have some good times. You're going to have some bad times.
Let's do this.
These are actuals, and you're going to have a budget of less than $10 billion to address today's problem. Today, I mean that's the equivalent of what it would be. I mean, it gives you, tells you where you're going to be, and you know, can you cut from $2 billion out of this budget? I think we've got a problem. Senator Perioli can, but I couldn't enlist.
I don't know. You get a whole group of people together in a room, and they can do some drive-by budget cutting.
I shouldn't have asked that question. You should always have somebody else. I didn't see Senator Perioli coming in.
Let's go ahead and have, at this time, Dallas Wine give us the two copies of the amendments so that we know what the amendments and what amendments are these, Dallas?
We have two amendments.
Thank you
very much.
Dash A10 and dash A11 to address a couple of what we've identified as concerns. The dash A10 amendment adds what I would call an emergency clause. It would allow the assembly, by a two-thirds vote, majority vote of all members of each house, to enact legislation to increase the biennium appropriation limit. So that in the case that it was needed, the assembly's hands is no longer tied, that with a two-thirds vote, it could pass appropriations that would be in it, would exceed the constitutional limitation. And that would be part of the Constitution. The assembly would be allowed by Constitution to do that. So that provides what we would call an emergency clause, that the assembly can go higher than the appropriation limit as said in the
similar to what the Hawaii president does, go higher than 50.
I think it may be a little higher standard here than Hawaii. Hawaii's maybe in a majority, I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, in Dallas, is there anything in this that is contemplated to be a trigger? Why would you want to override the constitutional amendment? And one of the things we've talked about, I know Raleigh and I have, and Mary Ann, is this issue of a rainy day fund. What triggers it? Is there an economic downturn of a certain percentage that would make that eligible, that kind of thing? If we're going to override something like this by a two-thirds majority, obviously two-thirds majorities aren't easy to come by in this building, but I would think there would have to be some very serious condition that would exist other than a differing opinion about the issue we have before us now in terms of K-12 funding, where we have a $400 million difference in what the governor originally proposed and the Senate proposed as to where he is today. Some would call that a funding crisis, but there's no objective criteria to reach that other than
two-thirds majority under this. Whether or not two-thirds of the folks in both houses felt like it was a sincere funding crisis. And at that particular point, then you break your spending limitation and you go through the barriers and certainly if the at-risk was the general obligation bonds of the state, I'm sure that the responsible thing to do for the legislators to do it rather than let the state go into default, which is, well, as indicated, would be catastrophic. You step up and pay your debt. And that's what it would appear to me, but I probably won't be part of the two-thirds one way or the other. So.
What is, Mr. Chair, if I may ask Dallas, what is the requirement in Hawaii to override?
Obvious, I don't remember. I really don't. Yeah, my knowledge is.
Does anyone know?
No. I'm just curious. Thought I would ask.
Okay, so the dash 10 amendments, A10 amendments, give you the override authority for the limitation. Dash 11?
Dash 11 tries to, in response to the concern that the interpretation of the
terms for such purposes might be read that each of these are appropriations. This would limit the appropriations on a program-by-program or line-by-line basis. This would insert the word aggregate in front of the word appropriations so that it would be the aggregate appropriations for state government expenditures would be no greater than the aggregate appropriations for such purposes. Again, to try to both to make it clearer to the reader that this is for the aggregate of general fund expenditures and not line by line. It's exactly with that in mind. Also in the Dash A11 amendment is, right now, paragraph 2 says this will be put before the voters in a special election in November. If there is no special election in this November, they will put it before the voters on the next upcoming biennial primary election. So it doesn't require a special election in November of this year for it to be put before the voters.
Sure. If this was held during a next biennial primary election, that would be subject to the 50% rule, correct? No?
Wouldn't be.
No, this is biennial primary election. If it doesn't...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it says biennial primary, so it would be subject to the 50% rule, would it not? Yeah.
Is that what the intent was?
You don't think so, Rich?
It's not exact.
It's not exact.
It's not exact.
Okay, so it would. Okay, yeah. All right.
Okay, I think this is written to the fiscal because of the cost of the special election. And then the ongoing fiscal impact that we're drafting would see about a $50,000 cost for each item that's put on a primary election. That has to do with the cost of the voter's pamphlet and the like, offset a little bit by voter's pamphlet revenue, but it's tend to minimize the cost to the state. And we have staff and representative Harper's office here, so correct me if I'm wrong in any of
this. Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Lynn.
And why is that Amendment Dash 11 goes into the primary or a special election instead of the general election? What's the reason for that? Any ideas for
that? Because it's only a little general election. The next general election will be in November of 2000. This will put it on the ballot. If there is no special election this November, it will put it on the ballot in the May primary. May 2000 primary.
So only about 6 months earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So the idea there, I would think, would be that it would be law and applicable to the 2001-2003 biennial budgeting periods.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, yes, the resolution is to take effect for the biennium beginning July 1, 2001. Understand that this cannot stand alone. It will need enabling legislation, and that can be addressed then by the Assembly at the same time it's addressed as working on the biennium 2001-2003 budget.
And then in the enabling legislation, some other issues that we've talked about, such as the de minimis issue that has been brought up, and
could
be addressed as well to overcome some of those issues there. Okay. So it becomes effective July 1st, 01.
For the biennium beginning July 1st, 2000.
And Mr. Warner is back. Paul,
help.
Yeah, we want to know, did we start this on July 1st, 2001? How much money we're going to get to spend for those folks who are here in that particular biennium?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Officer, and chart that you've got in front of you is one that I prepared and prepared a month or a half ago or so, and I've added a few things to it, and I'd like to go through that just to make sure that those numbers are clear, and because the chart has several objectives. The first thing is I've defined private income. I think it's pretty clear in the bill the way it's defined is Department of Commerce measure of income minus government wages and salaries. I've taken the annual change in that number since 1975. Then the five-year moving average is as the resolution specifies, and then generated an allowable growth, multiplying by two as for the budget period. And then I've looked at actual general fund revenues, and a couple of things I think stand out. What I've done is look at it as if the resolution were in place starting in the early 80s, to give you some sense of what impact it would have had. And if you do that, you notice in the early 80s that you're well below the limit. And of course, what's happening there is you had a period of fairly strong income growth. A lot of it was pure inflation. And that generated a lot of revenue growth. But by the early 80s, of course, as we all know, the revenue growth was much weaker as a result the Legislative Assembly was spending a lot less than what this limit would have allowed if it had been in place. So that's why you have those negatives in the early 80s. If you look at that column on the limit impact cumulative, you can see that it begins to have an effect in the 1989 budget period, 89-91, of $287 million. So it would have had an effect that period, and indeed would have had an effect in each of the biennia after that. If you were to start at one of those biennia, that GF above the limit shows you what it would be in any of those biennium if you were just starting it. So in the case of the current resolution, that's the highlighted number, the 267.4, under current projections, is where you would be above the limit for the 01-03 period. So if the 01 legislature comes in, this is what they'd be looking at, would be spending on the current projection, would be 267 above the limit.
Sure. Yes.
Question for you quickly here. In talking about that biennium, the $11.535 billion projected general fund income, is that correct?
President Crook, what I've done is take the governor's recommended budget, which is $10,181,000,000, and grown that by projected general fund revenue.
Of how much percentage?
The growth rate is right around 12%, under 12%.
Okay.
That was the figure that I used, was from the March revenue forecast. Okay. To go ahead and project that.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may,
sure, follow up.
The 11,535,000,000. The 267 is not included in that $11.5 billion figure.
So in other words, you're saying that the money that we're going to receive is 11.5, and out of that we're going to refund $267 million out of this because of this bill.
Correct.
Okay.
The limit would say that you can take the $10,181,000,000, if that's the budget, and grow it by 10.7%, which is what the allowable growth would be. And the projected growth is $267 million above that, projected revenue growth.
Okay.
So you would not, what it's saying in the current forecast, you had $267 million in general fund revenue that you couldn't spend under the limit.
So in actuality, Paul, you'd have to add that 267 figure to the 11.5, and that would actually be the total amount of money that actually came into the state treasury from these income sources, correct?
The 11.5 is what's projected.
Total projection.
Total general fund projected. That's above what the 10.7 growth rate would give you.
The 267 is above what the 10.7 growth rate would give.
So what you do, in order to get what you could spend, you'd have to take the 11,535 and subtract
the 267. Okay.
So that would be your allowable spending.
Yeah, forgive me, Paul, I'm just a
simple misnomer. They always says that.
It's kind of how I have to figure things on the farm.
Mr. Chair, the cumulative limit there, and my intention there to look at those difference actual versus what the limit would be, to give you some sense of how that might work over time. I'd like to say there are a couple of things to keep in mind, I think. First of all, I can argue this from my personal experience and the amount of hair I lost trying to forecast general fund revenue during the early 90s and mid-90s. We had very strong revenue growth at that time, unusually strong. Several things generated that, a strong overall state economy, although I know certainly Senator Farioli that some regions grew more slowly than that. But there was strong income growth on average for the state, and also there was very strong gains in capital gains from the stock market, which has been extraordinary by historical standards. You had the Dow Jones go up over 25% 4 years in a row. It's never happened. But that has two effects on these numbers. One is it doesn't show up in the private income figures. Capital gains are not treated as private income from current sources by this definition, by the Department of Commerce's definition. But, of course, it shows up as a lot of revenue growth. So you've got the tax revenue from those capital gains, but it's not showing up over here. So I think if you look back historically, this period of the 90s, mid-90s especially, a limit such as this that would have been in place would have had a more severe impact than it would over time. Finally, the last thing I'd like to say is that as you look over time at your revenue system, which is general fund, is going to be 90% income taxes, it's going to grow faster than this measure of income over time. I think that's a pretty safe bet. There's going to be periods when it doesn't, of course. It's a sensitive revenue source with respect to income. It's somewhat volatile, but over time it's what economists call elastic. So if you look over a 10-year period, you're going to see revenue growth faster than income growth. And what that means, I think, in terms of your policy choice here, is that a limit as specified here would be effective. I mean, it would have an impact over time. Maybe not as big as I've got here because of the unusual nature of the 90s, but I think it would, over a 10 or 20-year period, certainly would have an impact on government spending if it's adhered to.
Mr. Chair, questions?
Representative. You have to forgive me. I'm just a curious mind here. So if we go back to the 2001 biennium, 11.5, we subtract the 267 roughly, we come out with 11.268, something along that line. So then the next calculation that I would make is because you're projecting a total revenue income of $13 billion. Okay. But we're under this measure, this constitutional change, we're only going to allow 10.8%. So then I would take 10.8% times the $11.268 billion. Is that correct? Okay. All right, so my math is on track here.
In fact, what you've outlined is what this cumulative impact does, only it starts from a different date. It doesn't start from the day. It starts assuming that this was in effect in 1982. And that's exactly how I calculated that column, was by taking what your limited spending was and then applying the growth rate to it. So it does have that ratcheting down effect over time. Any limit of this nature would have that effect because you would be starting from your actual expenditures.
Representative Nesterling.
Mr. Warner, what would be the impact? Most of these figures come off of very low inflation times. What would be the impact if we see inflation start growing again?
Mr. Chair, the normal impact of inflation is to inflate income growth because these income numbers are not adjusted for inflation. So you'd see more rapid growth in that second column, and that would end up generating greater allowable growth, such as it did in the early 80s, as we had that big 24% in the early 80s. And then that would generate more revenue growth. So there would be some balancing out there. The one issue that I think that would come into play here would be if you had a rapid surge in inflation, because you've got a 5-year moving average here. So let's say that inflation rate jumped from 3 to 12%. Then you would really be constrained on how much you can spend. You'd probably have revenue flowing in rapidly, but your limit would be adjusting behind that. So it would have a significant impact if you saw a big jump in inflation. But over time, as long as inflation stays relatively a constant, whether it's 10% or 2%, then the five-year moving average eventually would pick that up.
And inflation having been low during these past number of years has the effect of doing what to the net bottom line then?
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, one of the unusual features, at least the way I was taught economics, macroeconomics, is that we not only had low inflation, we had very rapid growth, including rapid revenue growth. So you have very strong real growth is what's generating a lot of this allowable growth factor. The key here is not so much the, how much of that income growth is inflation and how much of it is real or increases in standard living, but it's just what that nominal personal income is. So even if you grow, for example, 5% a year with 5% inflation, your revenue is going to grow probably about 6% a year, and it's going to have that same effect.
I think it will, our state's going to become more and more, a higher percentage of our population is going to be a retired income. And I believe those people depend more on the capital gains for their income in their retired years. And if we require more services to that retired sector, are we creating an imbalance here, or could we?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mesley, I think that in terms of the sources of income, this private income measure is, again, this is one of the limitations about it. What it includes are what are called transfer payments. And actually, the majority of those transfer payments are Social Security transfer payments. So you're going to get your Social Security captured in that number. What you don't get in these numbers are pension income. Because the pension income, the way that the Department of Commerce accounts for it, it's when it accrues to your retirement account. So if you have a job and your employer is contributing to your pension account, that shows up as income in the current year. When it's paid out, it doesn't show up in these numbers. So what you would see happening, and I think you see that today in Oregon, part of the reason why our income is lower than it otherwise would be, you don't have the private pension numbers in here. To the extent they're growing rapidly, they're not going to be showing up in the rate of increase in your limit. So I think it would have an effect over time. The other issue, of course, and one that's before you, and I know was taken up by this committee, Senate Bill 7 and the taxation of private pension income. Of course, what that ultimately does is would take that out of the revenue stream if you stop taxing private pensions as well as public pensions, or at least
91. Is it included in the gross W-2? Is that what I understood you to say, that it is? It is already included in the gross W-2 as a firm.
Mr. Chair, there's two categories that go under this income definition that are related to this. One is just wage and salary, and benefits don't show up there. Where they show up is in a category called other labor income. And those are when an employer is putting money in your pension account, it shows up as other labor income.
It's included in the gross W-2 under the FICA portion under the gross benefit portion.
It's included when it accrues to the account, not when it's paid out to an
outlet. Before, you said that could be a factor. Is that a significant factor, or is it, can you quantify how big a factor that would be?
Mr. Chair, Wilson, it will be a bigger component of income over time as the population ages. And we have a higher dependency ratio, higher retirement population. I think it will be a bigger issue for some states than others, particularly those that are attractive for retirees. And I would put Oregon in that category. I don't think it would be something that would necessarily be you know, it's not something that's going to distort these numbers wildly by any means, but it would be a marginal factor that would slow the rate of growth here relative to the rate of growth in the tax base.
I'm looking at this from a few angles. Not only what would that give us for our limits in the budgeting, but what would the needs of public service be as we shift to the retired population? Are we going to get caught in the middle of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that is a major public policy issue. I don't necessarily think that a limit of this type, what it does is constrain the size of the public sector. So to the extent that you've got growing demands from any source, whether it be from retirees or from education or from corrections or any source, this does have a constraining effect.
And in that light, the retirees with under the 7, plus Senate Bill 7, which we have previously worked on, the income flow would be there, but it would not be it would not come into the taxable flow. And if you had a 2 plus input output turnover, it would turn over somewhere in the economy, which would generate additional private income somewhere in that process. And is there a special income input output number on that we use for private retirees? Approximately what is that multiplier?
Mr. Chair, anything that brings in income from the outside would have a multiplier effect. Whether it be Social Security payments, for example, would be an influx of income from the federal government. Private pensions would have that same effect. If you have people who work in Arizona all their lives, working lives, move to Oregon, then they're receiving a flow of pension income. It has that same effect as Social Security would, as an injection effect. That means that if you look at a standard multiplier analysis, it would be anywhere from 1 3/4 to 2, meaning that each dollar would generate about $1.75 in economic activity. And you're correct, the 75 cents or the dollar, the secondary effects would in all likelihood be taxable.
And that's the multiplier we use for pensions.
That's the multiplier that we use for most injections and what we use for transfer payments, for example.
I see. Okay. And so Social Security also would have that same multiplier then?
Yes, indeed. That's one of the areas that Oregon has benefited from in terms of influx of retirees is we receive more than our share from the federal government on a per capita basis and on Social Security payments.
Thank you very much. Are there further questions of Mr. Warner? We don't have a quorum here right now, but I just want to ask in that regard, relative to the issue, as we look at revenue, relative to the issue of retirees, would Oregon, have you done any kind of an analysis on what Oregon would look like being a retirement haven state relative to the costs, the social costs on schools and other? One of the concerns that I have is it takes X number of votes to get a school bond passed, and I want to know if it has very little to do with the current issue, but it has a lot to do when we look down the road at what Representative Krupp was getting at the social cost and livability. What does that give us a gaze into your crystal ball, if you would please fall in?
Again, Mr. Chair, I think that's it's a big picture issue that future legislatures are going to be dealing with the ramifications of it. One of the things that I think is pretty widely accepted in fiscal, and Dallas may comment on this too, that it's in terms of the expenditure impact, they tend to rise when you we get to be 75 and above. So that's the, you know, it's the elder, it's the older elderly that have a bigger budgetary impact. So the extent that occurs, I think you're looking at some budgetary consequences. I think tax policy obviously is an important factor long term of what happens to revenue. What you ultimately decide in terms of how much to tax on private public pensions, that's a key issue. And I think that you have to recognize that there's the issue of the elderly and elderly needs, but there's also generational changes that occur. Each generation has different characteristics, and we've yet to see exactly, you know, all the characteristics that will occur from the baby boomer generation. They may work longer years, for example. They may tend to be more actively involved in communities. They may want to live in rural areas more. I think there's probably some areas in this state that are very sparsely populated that will become much more densely populated. For some reason, they tend to attract retirees. And you've seen that to some extent so far now in some parts of the state that 10 or 15 years ago, you wouldn't have thought of as a retirement center, and they've become that way. And so I think we'll see some real regional development implications, too.
Particularly if we had an advantageous look at tax
laws. That shouldn't be a thing.
Thank you very much, Mr. Warner. Any further questions for Mr. Warner at this time? We've been asked to go ahead and take a vote on the amendments and House Senate resolution today. And so we're needing to go into work session and close the public session. And we'll do that at this time. We'll close the public session and open the work session on House Senate Resolution 35. We have before us the two sets of amendments, A-10 amendments and the A-11 amendments, which we've had an opportunity to go through. Are there any objections to include the A-10 amendment, which accommodates the emergency clause and picks up some of those vital issues that are concerned about how to get into how to get past the spending limitation in future years. If there are no objections to the A-10 amendment, I'll go ahead and order those included into House Fund Resolution 35. We have also then received the A-11 amendment, which includes some modification as well as an additional paragraph. The modification includes issues relative to the aggregation of programs, not program by program, but aggregate budget issues. And then the fiscal, to address some of the fiscal impact, taking this to the next biennial primary election, if there's no other special election. Are there any objections to the A-11 amendment? If there are no objections, seeing none, we'll go ahead and order those included into House Senate Resolution 35-A11 amended. At this time, I would entertain a motion to move on House Senate Resolution 35 as A11 amended. A10 and A11, right.
Through A11. So moved, Mr. Chair.
Moved by Senator Ferrioni. Any objections?
Mr. Chair, before we vote, let me state for the record that I approve of this concept and have all along. I have certain views regarding this matter, and I think this is an appropriate direction for us to go. I would like to have seen, and at some point in the process, would still like to see that some of this money that would be refunded. I'm coming up with some higher figures than what Paul is in terms of. Based on the projected growth in income revenue received by the state. I would still like to see a portion of that money set aside initially on some type of rainy day fund. I would really like to see us go in that direction that would have specific criteria established for the use of that rainy day fund. I'd like to see, would have really, really liked to have seen that in this bill. I will vote yes on this bill with that caveat in public record.
Chair, are you voting on this 35 now?
Yes, we will be.
Can I let you express my opinion?
Please.
And the concept is a good idea. I understand all the two states are a little brilliant, and I don't have a full knowledge of it. Is that the same thing or something different? And it seems to me I'm trying to swim in the dark, in the ocean. I hope that my sentiment is we create a task force to study further on this issue.
The tax issue in general.
Yes, issue. And then I think we need to define what is exactly general fund. It could be a many different interpretation. It might cause confusion. And then the fund portion in here, if you want to refund the money, it's going to cost at least $1 million. So if you have $100,000, how could you just be willing to decide some of those questions in here?
And we anticipate that the enabling legislation, which will be required to probably address that as to that particular portion of it, so that it was the de minimis portion of that, which is so small, when the cost or when the benefit cost ratio was such that it would not be economically feasible to refund money, then it would not be refunded.
Yeah, but according to this 35, but we have to get some of the money.
But the enabling legislation could when it's actually enacted, could address the issue of at what level, and so that the cost benefit ratio could.
So Mr. Chair, this is the constitutional change. Mm-hmm. When it's in the constitution, written in the stone, I'm not sure whether we could do anything about it as a legislator, unless it's changed by the constitution again. So my point is, I'm not comfortable to vote for this one yet, but still I might consider when it comes to the floor.
Okay, thank you.
I might still truly vote for the constitution.
Thank you.
And I must go ahead and have a roll call vote.
I'd like to make just a short comment.
He's that Senator Representative Messina.
I want to echo what Rich said itself. I think there is a piece of this legislation that is missing, and that is the reserve. And I think they will have to be in the same bill, but I think that we're missing an opportunity to use those extra revenues in not building this reserve. And I will be supporting the concept. I do believe in that. But I think we need to do some work on the reserve part of it too.
I think that we're probably unanimous in our concern to make sure that we have sufficient reserves, because that is a piece of the pie that's missing. And we also have the issue of the tax study. The whole concept of the entire, as Senator Lemon indicated, the entire concept needs to stop. We need to stop it at some point and study it. And there's lots of issues that really need to be addressed rather than come to in a piecemeal correct fashion, and I think that's been expressed in the two hearings we've had. Let's go ahead and do a roll call vote, if we may, Jamie.
Yes.
No.
Harry Oates.
Aye.
Ken.
Aye.
Mesley.
Aye.
Aye. We'll go ahead and order for a due pass recommendation to the full Ways and Means House Rank Resolution 35 as we go to day 10 and 11. Thank you very much. Let's see. When am I going to get this
going? Okay. Then it will get to just a question.
Okay. With that, we'll close House Senate Resolution 35, the work session, and we will get back on the important portions of the balance of the issues that have been raised. Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here with us. No, we'll continue on with 325, 328, 327, and we've been through public hearing on 327 already. Let me just make sure that we're okay.
Mr. Chair, do we need a quorum to go to work on these?
Yeah,
we better get them before they get too far down the hall.
We're going to grab the vote so that we get
that hook out and bring it up.
We'll stand at ease for just a couple of moments. Let's go at ease then, please. put up to the gold minute to find you. We'll come back to that.
It is in the measure.
First place I should have looked, knowing him.
Let's, for
the record, thank you.
Continue on. We have had
previous public testimony on 327. Rather substantial discussions on 327. Let's go ahead and we've got three bills relative to the public employee retirement system. I'd like to go ahead and have direction from legislative fiscal staff also.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 327 deals with providing additional retirement benefits to wildland firefighters in the Department of Forestry. For people who aren't classified as firefighters still all year round, but it was that period of the year that they would be classified, would be certified by the Department of Forestry that they serve as wildland firefighters. This would provide community fire retirement and disability benefits to them for that period of time that they are classified as wildland firefighters. It would be prospectively. The bill you have before you has two amendments that we have reviewed. The -84 amendment, which is really a more of a housekeeping amendment to assist with the Public Employees Benefit Board to enable people who are eligible to for retirement benefits to keep their medical insurance through the Public Employees Benefit Board. This is a no-cost item to the state. These members. Who are eligible for retirement, pay full cost of those medical benefits, but they get it reduced cost to the employee benefit board. That was at the request of the Department of Administrative Services and the Public Employees Benefit Board because of the related two clause. The -85 amendment you have before you, the bill as A and Growth has retroactive for benefits. The -85 amendment takes away. Does not make it retroactive, takes away the retroactive part of the benefit, but it does allow the employee to pay the full cost of purchasing prior service credit under this bill. We've had testimony in support of this from both the Public Employees Retirement System and representatives of the Oregon Public Employees Union. Thank you. Again, this would be a revised fiscal impact to show that the prospective nature of the cost of the additional retirement benefits are estimated to be about $200,000 per biennium. Of that, about $70,000 general fund, $200,000 for the other fund, spread across all state government. It does not impact upon local government units. It's entirely a state issue. That's the sum of the two amendments to the A and Gross version. You've heard testimony on both of those.
Okay, are there any items the members of the committee need to discuss before we go into work session on 327 with the -84 and -85 amendments before us? We've already had a public hearing on 327. Let's go then into a work session on Senate Bill 327. 327, the -84 amendments to incorporate the Public Employee Benefit Board into this bill, their request to use the PERS, the Public Employee Retirement System, as the vehicle for which they would pay their
using the bill as a vehicle.
As a vehicle to pay their insurance through this.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay, it's been moved to incorporate the -84 amendment into Senate Bill 327. Any objection? None noted. It is directed that we include the -84 amendment. -85 amendments. I want to just make certain. I believe we have Senator Duncan signing off on both days on 621.
Senator Duncan, Chair of the Trustee Committee, along with Senator Lim and Senator Stroh here, he has approved both of these amendments.
Okay. All right. Are there any objections to the inclusion of the dash A5 amendment to Senate Bill 327. Seeing none, we'll order that it's incorporated into Senate Bill 327. We have Senate Bill 327 A engrossed with these amendments through dash A5.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 327 through the full Ways and Means as engrossed with amendments 4 and 5.
Do pass recommendations. Any objections to the motion by Senator or Representative Krupp that we move Senate Bill 325 due pass for the full Ways and Means? Noting none, so ordered. And let's see, we'll have Representative Krupp carry that to the House.
Thank you.
And Senator Ferrioli, do you feel comfortable with that?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, but let me suggest that Representative Leonard has such strong feelings about this bill tonight. It would be appropriate to have him carry that bill to the full Ways and Means.
Let's have him do it to the full Ways and Means. Great. And so 327 is all taken care of. And 325. Now, did we ever officially open a public hearing on 325? I don't think we actually had.
Yes, it was just a slight reading.
Okay. So we better open a public hearing on 325. Dallas, Mr. Lyon, can you just give us a
brief thing? Yes, sir. Chairman, this is Senate Bill 325 allows public employees' retirement system members to purchase a prior service credit through a payroll deduction plan. If allowed by the IRS, the purchase under the payroll deduction plan may be made with pre-tax dollars. It was referred to Senate General Government Committee. It was recommended out with a due pass recommendation. It was subsequently referred to Ways and Means by President of the Senate. This was one that came out of Senator Duncan's committee, and did you want me to talk about the proposed amendment?
Yes, let's go ahead and get an amendment to it that Senator Duncan has offered.
Okay, we have in front of you a dash one amendment to Senate Bill 325. Again, we have approval from Senator Duncan. Senate Bill 325 allows, as it is drafted, allows the purchase of all prior service credits through the payroll deduction plan. A number of those prior service credits cost employers money because it requires the employees only to pay a portion. This dash one amendment, in effect, limits this payroll deduction option only to those employees who are eligible to purchase prior service credit for the full cost. These are the employees who can purchase prior service credit, and they will pay the entire cost. And that, in effect, is limited to those existing statutes. There are three sections. These are for military service that a person may have had prior to joining the public employees retirement system, prior teaching service, out-of-state teaching service, prior to joining the public employees retirement system, and for ordinary disability benefits credit. And again, under these three sections of the statute, the employee is responsible to pay the full cost of the benefit to the retirement system. The full cost, again, is defined to include not just the actuary cost of the retirement benefit, but any administrative costs. And we will be working with public employees and retirement system on setting up a method for them to capture those costs. So you have before you a new fiscal impact on the dash A draft amendment, which in effect points out this is to take effect in the next biennium, but it would allow the public employees and retirement system to start doing work on it, that the increased costs will be paid for by the people purchasing the credit. We do not know how much those costs will be at the time. It will depend a lot on the numbers of those requesting it. And also then, the revenues that will accrue to the retirement system to recover those costs. The point being that the employees who are purchasing the benefit will pay the entire cost of the benefit.
And that's the effect of the Dashwood Amendment.
Is there any question of what the definition then would be with regard to those folks who want to come in and participate and purchase the prior service credit and pay the full cost, recognizing that it's a limited small group that we're dealing with, but it deals with the ability to purchase the full cost purchase the prior credit, but must pay their full cost, and that cost issue will be worked out with the BERS. In other words, there's no free lunch here as we move through the system and bring new folks in and have everyone pay for the service that's rather expensive actuarial numbers that we've already looked at when they went through the budget for the public employee retirement system. They set up special plans for these various types of special units and additional costs. So,
Mr. Chair, how small are the numbers?
They vary widely depending upon who wants to purchase in and what it is. For instance, a teacher that's taught 1 year out of state and wants to buy the full year's worth of credit could purchase that for the dollar for dollar amount, and then whatever the cost it is to make that computation.
Senate Bill 325, the Dashwood Amendments, or as amended, would allow these people to buy the full cost, but would allow them to do it over time through payroll deduction, whereas right now, as you mentioned, it's a lump sum purchase. So for example, a teacher that comes into Oregon may want to purchase prior service credit from for service in another state, but may be prohibited because it's costly in a lump sum.
Unless it costs you, because this is the one of the best information, anyone coming in here is a fool if not to join it. So do we have any estimation of how many people will be joining it? Any idea?
We have representatives in public employees retirement system who may be able to address that.
And it's not mandatory to it would just be their opportunity to do so, and they could do so under the Dashwood Amendment with the after-tax dollars if that can be.
The state government has to continue to pay them 8% plus any others in the future, I guess.
PERS system, yes. Be under Tier 2 or Tier 3,
whichever they would come under at that point. And there wouldn't be under Tier 3, there would be no guarantee that there would be 8%.
Well, that the equivalent employee, they are getting a guaranteed 8%.
Tier 3 is still a highly critical situation.
Tier 1 gets guaranteed.
I think it's Tier 2 is guaranteed. So
yeah, Steve, would you like to tell us, we're telling you your business here, and we better get it on the record right.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Steve Delaney, Manager of Government Relations at PERS. Senator Lynn, to your question, first let me comment on the number of people that have had estimates in the past year. We are looking at about 1,082 estimates, people that have called and asked, and that's for all three kinds of full-cost purchases, teacher, military, and the non-duty disability. With regard to the guarantee, the amounts being allowed here do not have a guarantee, because this is a benefit being paid to a person after retirement. So the guarantee is to an individual prior to retirement. So we're talking with a full-cost purchase. We're talking about what does the person purchase at retirement to be paid out to them into the future. The actuary does include expectation with regard to the cost of living adjustment that would be paid to an individual. That is added in as a cost that must be paid by the member in order to get this additional benefit paid out to them.
What else can you say by money match program? Are they allowed to do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynn, yes, it can fall either under money match or full formula. In general, for a money match purchase, it's a very small purchase because they're purchasing time, and the time doesn't play a piece or play a part, excuse me, with regard to the benefit. Usually the amount is covering any additional health insurance benefits that might be payable to the person because of getting this additional time. In round figures for money match, they've been running around $2,000 more or less for an individual, whereas a person going out under full formula, they've been running more in the area of $40,000 to $50,000 because they're including additional time, which goes into that formula calculation.
Are they going into the tier 2 going into, or which program are they going into in case it becomes the law?
Chair Senator Lynn, it would apply to either tier.
Okay.
And then when you say the employee pays full cost, or that means the employer does not have to equal the money. The employee has to pay.
Yes, I understand. Yes, the full cost they have to pay.
And the included in the full cost is the cost of the actuary and the other overhead costs that are incurred by the PERS system in order to give the 1,082 annual estimates or the estimates out to the people who are making inquiry to come in and join into the system.
Yeah, I support the bill, but in my last 7 years as a state senator, I began to see that the many groups going into this closed system, getting a small group, and eventually when we combine together, they are becoming a large group. I'm not sure whether the approach system is sustained in the future. We are beginning to look at it, you know, that some danger in it, I begin to see.
I'd like to have Director McDonald maybe just give us a degree of his level of comfort about the financial stability of the system, so that he can share that with us and maybe as far as some of your concerns, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator McDonald, first director, Senator Lim, I would offer to you what Dallas and others have already said, and that is, on this bill, it does definitely say the full cost will be paid by the individual. We have had other bills where that has not been the case. And indeed, one person, one group becomes more people, more groups, and that has had the effect of adding to the cost. And I think, though, the way this bill is presently written, that, and in fact, I can assure you that the way this bill is presently written, that the full actuarial cost will be recovered by the system. And we take that very literally. We take that very literally, that will include administrative costs, that will include the cost of providing the benefits, and as Steve indicated, the COLAs that come thereafter, as well as the medical insurance subsidy. As long as the bill is written that way, then we are commissioned to make certain that occurs. But what you say is very true. There have been other bills that maybe it's very subtle, but have represented other costs, additional costs.
Senator Lim, we're at a crossroads, and you've recognized that, and you're astute to all recognize that you're an astute businessman. But lots of people want to jump in because it looks awfully good, and it has been awfully good. They've done very, very well, been well managed, it's been well invested, and so lots of people want to jump on that train. Well, pretty soon you got people hanging off the side, and they're not paying the freight. And the concern is that in the future, and as I say, this is a crossroads, this is a new threshold that we're going over to say that if you're going to participate under these particular types of participation that have been mentioned in the -1 amendment, that will be done via a different approach, and that is a full cost approach.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, a question in regards to this bill. Perhaps you can answer this for me. I don't know, gentlemen. It appears this applies to classifications of employees that are currently eligible for PERS if they were employed in the service of either the state or school districts or whatever. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Trump, it applies, as was indicated earlier, the way the bill is presently written to wildland firefighters if Senate Bill 327 does go all the way and is signed into law. It would apply to those folks. It also applies to teachers who come in from other states, can purchase up to 4 years of service on a full-cost basis. And it would also, and they could bring money in from their other systems, and that's the rollover part of it. And it would also apply to, as Steve had indicated earlier, to veterans, again, up to 4 years of service. There are some restrictions there. If they, veterans, for example, participate in another retirement plan, their own military retirement plan, then they can't buy these 4 years. So, but it's those groups. Now, as I recall, the way we originally submitted this bill, it applied to everybody. We would allow everybody who comes into the system to bring and to do a rollover and you know, there were some additional administrative costs, and it wasn't a full cost purchase kind of a situation. So there were administrative costs involved, but that's not the way the bill was constructed now.
Mr. Chairman, there was a previous bill in this legislature, and I don't know where it is. It hasn't come through any substitute committee that I'm aware of. We haven't voted on it. That allowed police and fire, in certain circumstances, dispatchers to be eligible for the PERS system. And I don't see that they would be named in here and eligible, because they're not currently eligible, is my understanding. And in some cases, I think that's wholly appropriate. I have the Lebanon Police Department dispatches for the Lebanon Fire Department and the Lebanon Police Department. They are in the police station, and they sometimes have to help restrain prisoners because there's a jail there. That's the lockup in the Lebanon City Hall when they arrest someone and bring them in, and they're subject to the same risks of infection, violent offenders, and so forth. And although very few large metropolitan dispatch centers are in that type of a situation, there are many rural dispatch centers that are. And I was hoping that that bill would have made its way through the system. Apparently it is not, unless you know of
Mr. Chairman, Representative Trump. I concur. To our knowledge, that has not made it to hearing. And if it did, it would have been subjected to the same scrutiny that this bill has been subjected to.
And Representative, on page 3 of Senate Bill 327, there is a delineation that goes on from there. This is as the 327, which was previously passed earlier today, gives those the definition of the pension there. And of course, remember we added some of the state foresters
right in
that 327.
Dispatchers are not eligible, as I understand.
That's correct.
And in some cases, I think they should be. That's just my comment.
That's true, Representative Cuff, Mr. Chairman, and the 9/11 operators.
Yes.
I mean, there's a good case to be made for that. And the case has been made, but it's so far it's not been successful. Totally successful, yeah.
Let's see. We may have one other question relative to some those who participate. Not sure whether or not we get that question answered to the satisfaction of Mr. Wyman. We get that taken care of.
He had a question.
Okay.
I guess the question is if the money. The full cost. The way it's written is full cost.
Yeah.
Now, the question is, if the money goes into the system, is it put into their accounts then, or is it just added to it, or it's just, it is not?
Correct. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Pei, it is not put into their account, and the account is defined by the contributions that an employee submits to the system, 6% of pay, most employers pick it up, but also augmented by the employer contribution, which can vary by employer. Those dollars go into the member's account, and that account has interest that is added to it over the life of that person's employment. That's the account. This money goes into another account that is completely separate from that account, and it does accumulate earnings on it as invested by the Oregon Investment Council, and it's paid out at a lump sum at retirement. I mean, it's completely separate and aside from the account. And I speak in that terminology based upon our accounting and the fact that the whole bill from the very beginning was designed not to be included in the member account.
Okay. Are there other questions of Director McDonald or Mr. Delaney at this time? If not, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill.
See, we had basically that 328. I guess it's 328. We'll hold a public hearing on it in just a moment. But we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 325. And we have the -1 amendments. We're going to work session on Senate Bill 325.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments under Senate Bill 325.
Representative Krupp now moves Senate Bill 325-1 amendments. Any objection? Being none indicated, we'll go ahead and incorporate the -1 amendments into 325.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 325 as amended -1s to the full Ways and Means of Reform.
It's been moved by Representative Krupp to move Senate Bill 325 to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? There being none unrecognized, we'll go ahead and pass that to the full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation, 325. And let's see, Representative Krupp, would you like to carry that on the floor?
Absolutely.
Okay. And let's see. Senator Lynn,
you're
the
carry.
Would you like to carry it to the Senate?
Sure, no problem.
Okay, certainly. Yes. And full Ways and Means.
As you wish, Mr.
Senator Federley. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, we have one more bill we're going to work out here today.
And we're just going to do public hearing on it.
Oh, yeah, okay.
We'll right. Just do public hearing.
Okay. You can go.
Okay.
Is it now or before?
We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 328. Mr. Wine, would you like to, this is the third of three PERS bills. Would you like to tell us about 328? Yeah, we'll just do public hearing. Okay.
328 in gross version allows public employees' retirement system members to make rollover contributions into the public employees' retirement system. The rollover contributions must be from a qualified retirement plan. The rollover account must be kept separate from all other accounts. And a member may use the rollover account balance to purchase additional retirement benefits, again, full cost. It was referred to the Senate General Government Committee and recommended out with a due pass recommendation for the A gross version. The third way is used by President of the Senate. We have again, reviewed this with Senator Durkin. It came out of his committee. We have a -A2 amendment. I referred to it to a -1 amendment. We have a -A2 amendment to this bill, which would change the fiscal impact. And the amendment, the bill as drafted allows, it says that the Public Employees Retirement Board may establish a fee to recover costs to maintain this. The -A2 amendment changes the may to shall, that the board shall establish fees by rule. And it also adds that the fee shall be in the amount determined by the board to be adequate to pay the full cost to the system of maintaining the oil there. So, again, in line with the prior bills that those wishing to avail themselves of this option, this additional benefit, will pay the full cost of that benefit. So you have before you, and again, Senator Duncan approved that.
The Dash A2 amendment.
And the revised fiscal then notes that, in effect, any additional costs would have to be recovered from the persons that avail themselves of this benefit.
So no fiscal cost to the public employee retirement system. The Dash A2 amendments would pass that cross on by including the word shall. Would be inserted so that the employee would take care of himself. We'd like to go ahead and invite Director McDonald and Mr. Delaney to respond. We would appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, friend of the Connelly, and the director occurs. The bill has been explained well, and I can talk some more, but I don't think I could add anything more particularly of value. The purpose of this bill, I will say, however, is that portability is an issue in retirement systems, of being able to attract and recruit people. For example, universities in our state try to attract people from out of state, and anything that can be provided in a retirement plan to help portability of retirement assets from one plan to another was what motivated the PERS board to introduce this bill in the first place. The bill has been changed considerably since it was introduced, in that it applied to anyone who had come into our system, and now it would it's much more focused. So, and as Ms. Ryan already indicated, from the fiscal impact standpoint, administrative costs will be recovered from those who participate. And we do ask, though, for a delayed implementation for internal systems purposes. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll close and certainly available for any questions.
And for the record, Section 3 of this 1999 Act becomes operative July 1st, 2002. Is that what we're referring
That's
to?
Correct, that's correct, Mr. Chairman. July 1, 2002.
Okay. Right. Mr. Delaney, did you have anything to add to that then?
Mr. Chairman, I'm fine.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, Steve just slipped me or passed me a note and corrected me in saying that it still applies to everyone. I got it mixed up with the other 325, which just applied to the full cost purchases. But on the other, it applies to anyone, but can only be used for full cost purchases. So it's not just the military people or the education people or the firefighters. It's to anyone, but they have to pay a full cost of it.
And will that be available on time to be able to purchase that over a period of time?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chairman. I think that is
cash up front.
They're bringing it in. So
transfer.
That's
so
right. They have to either bring it or
dollar.
Bring it or not bring it.
Okay. There would be no time payment here because you've got to transfer everything
right
over.
That's correct.
In one fell swoop. Okay. Applies to all new, but only for full cost purchases because it's a transfer. And this could come from other state retirement systems or private college retirement.
Not private, not, Mr. Chairman, only tax qualified plans.
Okay.
Which would be governmental plans, essentially.
Any other questions? Senator Crail is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The comments clarifying which plans are covered caused me to question whether or not I fully understand the concept of rollover contributions. And I guess I'd ask them if it just would apply to everyone currently covered or anticipated to be covered under the public employees retirement system. Would this include self-directed IRAs or KEO plans or other plans that were developed for the employee that would come?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ferrioli, in earlier conversations with the Attorney General's office, they indicated as long as it was a tax-qualified plan. I don't, not being an attorney, I don't recall if their determination was that the KEO plan was a tax-qualified in the sense that they're using the term as far as being a fully qualified pension plan. But they did indicate that a private pension plan would qualify just as would a public pension plan if it's a tax-qualified retirement plan.
I guess what I'm really concerned about is there are probably tens of thousands of employees that are currently vested in HERS that for at one period or another were not covered with any program who avail themselves of the window of opportunity for contributions to individual retirement accounts. And they were, in fact, tax-deferred accounts. Is that what is meant by tax-qualified?
Mr. Chair, thank you very early. No, it's not at this time. However, we are aware that there is federal legislation being considered that's trying to make that a possibility in the future, but at this time they would not be.
Senator, the IRAs and the SEP programs are not technically tax-qualified programs. Those are individual retirement and self-employed programs, and those are specialized types of programs. And the tax-qualified program, and I've asked Dallas to just spend just a moment on that, we're interested in making sure that at no time do we accept any funds into the PERF which would endanger any of our status as a fully tax-qualified program for the tens of thousands of beneficiaries, potential beneficiaries that are under this program.
I think that's the reason it's written this way, to accept only tax-qualified, money from tax-qualified plans, because to keep the public employees' retirement system as a tax-qualified plan.
Then if federal law does change to acknowledge IRAs, SEPs, and other, even a 401k, if it's not quote-unquote tax-qualified, presently, if they subsequently become eligible, and even if that person was then presently already participating in the PERS system, had 5 or 6 years, and found that they could roll that into it, and found that they did not want the responsibility of managing that money themselves under an IRA, a self-directed IRA, or whatever at that particular point, because it's a rollover account, it has some specialized costs to it, too. And those costs, the person would bear themselves. A rollover account, by its very nature, has to be maintained separately from it cannot be commingled. I mean, the fund can certainly be co-invested, it can't be commingled, and it has to be reported separately. So there would be a management fee, in effect, I don't know, I think my bank charges $12.50 for any rollover account on an annual basis. And so, I mean, whatever your interest is last year, then on top of that, you pay a $12 per month. I don't know. I'm not going to set the fees for the PERS. I'm sure they'll come up with a fee system that will be fair and adequate to compensate for their overhead. But the issue, Senator Ferrioli, basically came down, as we boiled down the issues, was one of fairness to the participants. Again, and Senator Lynn says, yeah, it looks like the box car was full of people, or the train car was full of people, and then you loaded on another 500 people, and the rest of the folks are hanging off the sides, and they're not paying the freight, but they're getting to the same place. And the people that are already there have basically paid the freight, and they've been there all along. And this kind of, as I say, it's a new direction. We would like to make sure that the existing employees are protected, and that new participants coming in from the outside, particularly, are able to participate, eligible to participate, and have the benefit
and enjoy the participation blessings of being able to participate in a very well-managed, very thoughtfully organized program, but they will pay their, they'll get their ticket punched too.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the question I have is then, the only tax-qualified rollover accounts would be coming from public employees.
Right now, basically government plans, I'm not sure, I've got to look upstairs that I could go through with you, Senator Ferrioli, but I think the 401k would even be a stretch for right now. It does not qualify.
At the moment, it does not.
Does not qualify. And so, you got a 401b, I think, which is a government plan from another type of government. There's some other that would probably qualify that are treated as qualified plans.
Can I give an example of a qualified plan? Is it not derived from government employment?
An example, Senator, of a qualified plan that is a non-governmental plan?
Nonprofit. Nonprofits and colleges. A nonprofit organization would have a 401b. Could have a 401b, a nonprofit organization. But more often than not, I think, Senator, you're talking about the opportunity for teachers to come in from other systems, attracting the best of teachers back, attracting the best of whatever back that come back in for public employee systems.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, you can see the thrust of my question. It seems that we're creating two sets of enablements or enabled citizens. One is the private sector citizen who has no access to the benefits, and the other is the public sector citizen who seems to be getting an opportunity to buy in. There are tens of thousands of Oregonians who have at one point or another become vested in the first program. And I have very clear communications for many that would like to participate by moving retirement accounts that they have into the system, even if they had to pay the management cost.
Mm-hmm.
That change has always been vigorously resisted by the management, of course.
Let me just respond to that from a little bit of tax background, and I'm not sure what resistance we would meet at PERS as much as we're meeting the Internal Revenue Service. Internal Revenue Service has been the primary party to stop that from happening. They don't want to allow commingling of one type of retirement with another type. And I'm not exactly certain why that has been that way, but I think Mr. Delaney is making reference to the potential of some discussion in Washington now of saying, rather than having a dual class citizenship, you can maybe roll it in, and that would be a great blessing for those folks.
We are prevented from bringing any qualified plan money into our system because we would risk the loss of our qualification status. So that means that any plan that is not a qualified plan, we just don't want to have any part of, because it would mean that our tax situation would change drastically. Now, there's been a lot of discussion, and we've been a part of it, of making plans like PERS available to the private sector. And I think that may be something that there is some hope for in the future. But at the present time, we're just precluded by the IRC from doing that.
I guess a couple of other questions. Employees now make contributions directly to PERS from their own income stream, and that can be even made variable. There's deferred compensation, I understand that.
Deferred compensation separate from it, but is administered by the PERS system, yes, sir.
Yes.
So state employees are free to make additional contributions to PERS.
But it's a separate plan, Senator. It's not part of PERS technically. There's no match, there's no employer money. It's a different animal, but they can.
However, it's managed by PERS in the same way as the corpus of the balance of the funds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So in effect, these public citizens have the access to the management expertise of the state of Oregon in developing a retirement account, having an investment plan,
That's for the deferred compensation portion, up to 25% of their current compensation.
So we have the first retiree. Is there any circumstance under which a non-state employee participates in FERS, for instance, a consultant who has an active FERS account? Can they make contributions on deferred compensation basis?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, no, they cannot. And we would not accept that so long as we have full knowledge that that person is not an employee of an authorized employer that we work with. And, of course, we do work with the employer who submits the deferred compensation contributions to us. So we know where it's coming from. And so the answer is no, they cannot participate. That's a 457 plan. Now, the private folks have their 401ks and IRAs and other kinds of tax-deferred type plans. Teachers have 403Bs, which is the same kind of a thing, a tax-deferred type of a plan, and the 457 plan is no different than that, basically.
Senator, give us to where you're headed.
Well, actually, it's just the idea that there are many employees in the state of Oregon that have been in the FERS system, vested in the FERS system, left public employment, returned to public employment after a period of time. Those folks are offered an opportunity at some point in time if they withdrew FERS retirement money to restore it.
That's correct.
So I guess I'm getting and nibbling at the edges of the issue where there are some people that are allowed to make direct contributions to FERS, even from income derived from outside of public employment. They're achieving a benefit.
Oh, no, wait a minute. Back up from
let me give you the example again, Mr. Chairman. There's some folks who have worked for the public system who've been employees who are vested. They have left public employment.
They have their account with the
withdrawn their account.
Withdrawn it. Okay.
So have been reemployed in the public sector. And they're given a period of time, I think 18 months, which to restore the funds to FERS and buy back the amount that they withdrew.
Okay, is the 18 months?
Chairman, Senator Ferrioli, they can, but that is only the money that they withdrew from FERS, not any additional that they may have made from that money through other investments. They can only put back in what they withdrew, plus interest.
So my point is, you have a person coming from the private sector who can buy in first under certain circumstances.
When they come back to public sector work.
But only for the time that they had, service time that they had previously put with a first public employer. So they may have gone into the private sector, but their private work has no bearing on what they put back into the system.
So, Mr. Chairman, what I'm getting at is that there's a number of circumstances, in my opinion, that we are actually creating a discriminatory gateway for certain employees to be able to participate in FERS. It is a public employee's retirement system, after all. But there seems to be some wavering in terms of, created by circumstance and eligibility that has been created over the years. I would welcome the concept of being able to open FERS membership and ability to contribute to anyone who's currently or has been vested in FERS. Because I think once the account's open and the medical expenses are being borne by the system, there's no reason to exclude the employee from continuing to contribute in the program. And I would hope that there's some research being done to change the federal tax code to allow that to happen. Since it seems anomalous that we allow a private sector person to come from the private sector having once been a public employee, take money derived from a system or from income wholly outside the public sector, but buy their way back into the FERS system, even though it is for that period of time with interest that they were there. But, I mean, I see some anomalies there, and it leads me to believe that that may be the camel's nose. Yeah.
I think it's a great discussion, and we have basically the direction that you're headed. You're never around the corners of it, but the direction that you're headed is, Senator Ferrioli, as I see it, is that, and we're on some ground that some folks you're not going to care much for in the industry, and that is you're on the ground where
basically you're stepping into an area where you say, here's a very well-managed organization, just happens to have some quasi-municipal background to it. They are charging full fare for those people who are going to participate. What's different from this company that is any different from joining one with Peyton Weber or Merrill Lynch or whomever? Why, you know, at this particular point, if we're going to be at some point in the future allow full price purchases or rollovers, if you will, into the system, why not go ahead and say, fine, let's open the floodgates and allow, as long as they're paying full freight for their participation, allow them to become an investment house on behalf of not just the public employee retirees and their beneficiaries, but for anyone else that wants to roll into it that's presently a public employee, whether they participated in it previously or not, I'm going to guess that part of the mission and part of the overall structure of the CERS system would have to change to accommodate that, because presently I'm going to guess that their tax exempt status is a qualified program. And there are companies, there are institutions which have qualified programs and run your teachers programs. I think I can use the name of an insurance company. John Alden runs for school teachers in the state of Idaho, and we'll be happy to take your IRA contribution, your SEP contribution, your KEEL, your HR10, your 401k, or any other as well, and you just sign up for it. And the direction that you're headed is one that certainly could be explored. But the first responsibility we do have is certainly to the current public employees and their beneficiaries. And then I think we could certainly look at the other portion of it. Recognize you're going to have banks and insurance companies come swarming down on us with hellfire and damnation.
As they did when the Safe Insurance Corporation was spun off into a quasi independent private organization. And I expect they'd have the same result. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That concludes my line of questioning.
any further before we hear further testimony from those who signed up? Thank you for tolerating us.
Thank you.
It's always enjoyable. Thank you very much.
You.
We do have Samara Dykeman, who has signed up on behalf of the Community College Association. Samara, welcome.
Thank you. Samara Dykeman representing the Community College Association. I'll be very, very brief. We worked with PERS on this bill during the interim because portability is a very important issue for us as employers. We have about 9.5% of our employees eligible to retire currently. We're recruiting out of state. Unlike higher ed, we do not have optional retirement plans available to us. So the only way that we can be portable is through the PERS system. And this would help us, new employees want to house all the retirement under one system instead of having something in Virginia and something in Oregon and something in Florida. And so this would help with the convenience, and we agree with the amendment that would clarify that those employees would bear the full cost.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Any further testimony? Rich is a thumbs up on this. How about members of the committee? Working our way down. We'll go ahead now and close the public hearing portion. Let's close it and just adjourn it over to tomorrow, and we'll carry over Senate Bill 328 until tomorrow's regular work session and public hearing. Thank you very much.